Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, take a second and think about all the things you have to remember every day. Where your keys are, doctor's appointments, birthdays, website usernames and passwords ad infinitum, meetings, bills to pay, friends to call. I mean, the list is endless. And how often do you forget some of those things? Be honest. A lot, I bet. Well, at least I do. That's because we're living in an unprecedented age of personal big data. The stream is unending, and our brains just aren't evolved to keep up. It's frustrating, especially today, where being sharp and organized might be the keys to personal and professional success. So in his new book, The Organized Mind, famed cognitive psychologist Daniel Levitin takes us on a tour of what neuroscience has to say about how our brains process massive flows of data. And he offers some tips on how to think straight in the age of information overload. Levitin is also author of the best-selling book, This Is Your Brain on Music, and he'll be speaking at the Brookline Booksmith tonight, but he joins us now in the studio. Daniel Levitin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So the new book is The Organized Mind, and let me tell you, I was desperate to look at all the little tips that you have here on how to be organized, and we'll get to them in a moment. But can we just first start with sort of what you have discovered as what our basic understanding of how the brain works and why we can't keep up with the flow of information we're faced with today?
Well, neuroscience has learned a lot in the last 10 or 15 years about why the brain pays attention to some things and forgets other things, and a lot of that information hasn't trickled down to the average person. That's why I wrote the book. For example, the number of things that you can keep track of at once is limited to about four.
Four.
So what experts recommend and what the neuroscience says very strongly is that if you can get stuff out of your brain and out there into the world, something called externalizing your memory, it frees up your brain to be uncluttered and to think about the things you really want to think about, not those nagging voices like, did I remember to turn off the pilot light when I left the house? And, oh, I have to remember to make that call that I said I was going to do, and I have to remember to buy milk on the way home. You get all that stuff out of your brain, and then you can concentrate on work and leisure activities more fully.
Yeah, but I imagine nobody hearing this is thinking, oh yeah, I can limit what I have to think about to four things at one time. I mean, it just seems impossible in the modern age.
Well, part of this is the myth of multitasking. So just across the river at MIT, there's been a lot of work done on this. And what it turns out is that we think we're multitasking, but we're not. We're actually, the brain is sequential tasking. We flit from one thought to the next very, very rapidly, giving us the illusion that what we're doing is doing all these things at once. But I'm here to tell you, as a neuroscientist, just because we think we're doing something doesn't mean we are. Our brains are very, very good at self-delusion. For example, I think I'm a lot better looking after I've been drinking a lot.
Suddenly I'm feeling very self-conscious because when I'm in the studio every day, I've got to look at a clock, look at two computer screens, keep track of my scripts, and also the most important thing is listen to the conversation that I'm having. And now I'm just feeling like I'm not doing any of those things well.
I actually blanked on the name of Earl Miller, who had done a lot of the work on multitasking over at MIT for a moment there. So the problem is we think we're multitasking. We're not. What happens is it releases the stress hormone cortisol in the brain, which leads to foggy thinking. So you're not even able to judge well whether you're working well or not. It's sort of like the way, you know, drinking can cloud your perception of whether you're a good driver or not. In addition to the release of cortisol, which is toxic, what happens is that you're depleting chemicals in your brain that are used to switch from one activity to another. After a couple of hours of that, if you feel depleted, it's because you've literally depleted the energy source of your brain, glucose.
Mm. Well, in your book, you write about how one of the key problems here is that how we live has evolved at light speed, whereas our brains, because they are biological, evolves at the pace of evolution over the course of millions and millions of years. And so we still have the hunter-gatherer brains of our long ancestors.
This is a concept that I find really intriguing, and I learned about it from my colleague Robert Sapolsky, the biologist who wrote the book Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It's called evolutionary lag. It takes a while for the genes to catch up to conditions in the environment. And by some estimates, our brains are configured to deal with the world the way it was 10,000 years ago. And, you know, evolution takes time. It takes hundreds or thousands of generations. So when you think back to what our hunter-gatherer lives were like, we might only have encountered a couple of hundred people in our entire lives. Hmm. Now you walk in downtown Boston for an hour, you'll run into 1,000 people. And in terms of information, there wasn't that much information known about the world 10,000 years ago. By some estimates, we've created as much scientific information in the last 20 years as all of human history before it.
Is it also at issue the type of information that we're asked to absorb now? Because, I mean, I imagine a hunter-gatherer, you say this as much in the book, like, that's one of the reasons why because of our hunter-gatherer brains, we're actually really good at memorizing how to walk to certain places, because geographic information is key to survival. But maybe we're not so good at remembering 57 people's different birth dates.
Right, or passwords.
Passwords,
arbitrary
yeah.
strings right. of digits and letters with special characters. Right, our brain isn't configured for that kind of stuff, for things that seem arbitrary or for things that lack patterns. But it's very good at perceiving patterns. So part of the idea of exploiting what we know about neuroscience is to use patterns wherever you can.
Mm-hmm.
A password tip. Think of a phrase that you'll always remember, like my favorite station is WBUR.
Okay.
And then take the first letters of each word,
M-F-S-I-W-B-U-R. Okay.
That becomes your password. And then nobody's going to crack it because it seems like random letters. And then if you want to be extra secure, add on little things to it. So if it's your password for Filene's, you add a letter F at the end. If it's your password for your Visa card, you add a V at the end, things like that.
Yeah. Well, so that's one of the several tips that you have in the book, The Organized Mind. And I want to get to more of them in just a moment. But there is something that emerged when I was reading that I found very surprising, actually, that you say when it comes to our overall level of organization, the tools we use, how we approach being organized in the world, you know, our minds, et cetera. One of the biggest factors, you say, is conscientiousness.
Yeah. So this comes from personality and individual differences psychology. Of the thousands of ways that humans differ from one another, turns out there's this one cluster of traits called conscientiousness that predict a whole host of positive life outcomes, such as longevity, overall health, life satisfaction. It's inversely correlated with the likelihood you'll end up in prison. That is, it predicts that you won't end up in prison. And conscientiousness includes things like doing what you say you'll do, being dependable, being organized. So you can spin a story for why this might be so. Someone conscientious is more likely to see the doctor when they need to have a doctor, to have insurance.
Well, listeners, I'm speaking with Daniel Levitin. His new book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload, I should say. Daniel Levitin is the author of the best-selling book, This Is Your Brain on Music. He's going to be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight talking about The Organized Mind. And if you've got a question for him on how to make your mind and your life a little more organized, and these are tips based on neuroscience, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Okay, so let's get to some of these strategies, because you break them down into several different categories in the book. And let's start with just one of the places where people probably should be the most organized but might be the least, and that is in their very own homes. You have some strategies to highlight home-based organization?
Well, so what a lot of people say is that they lose their car keys, their house keys, they lose their reading glasses or their passport. And you were talking earlier about hunter-gatherers remembering the route that they had to take to get to a fruit tree or to a well. We have exquisite place memory in a beautiful structure in the brain called the hippocampus. We share this with all mammals. It's the part of the brain that tells a squirrel where it buried its nuts. And so we can exploit this. The problem is if you put your keys down just anywhere in your apartment or your home, they can be just anywhere, and your brain can't keep track of it. Your brain isn't good at keeping track of things that move around, but it's very good at keeping track of things that are in the same place. So the trick is you put a little hook by the front door, you have a decorative bowl on a console table. That becomes the designated spot for your keys or your reading glasses. And because you always put them there, they're always where you expect to find them.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. What about things like, I'm just thinking of my own home right now. There, we have this sort of bookshelf, or a series of bookshelves, which is just packed full with every kind of book, pieces of paper, children's drawings, plants, you know, whatever. It's a bit of a mess, but it's sort of the place where all the stuff that we really love but may not use a lot kind of goes at the same time.
I'm glad you shared this, because it's conceptually similar to the kitchen junk drawer that everybody has, right?
Yeah.
And I think it represents a triumph of cognitive economy.
I just see it as a terrible mess.
Well, the way I see it is one of the things I interviewed a lot. I spent time with a lot of very successful people, CEOs, government, military leaders, artists, scientists, Nobel Prize winners, asking them what their strategies are. And one of the biggest strategies that came up over and over again is don't spend more time on a decision than it's worth.
Okay.
So you've got something in your hand. And there's probably a perfect place for it in your home, and you could spend a long time thinking about the perfect cubby hole or closet or drawer. But what you're doing is saying, I'm going to put it here in the family bookshelf because it's not worth investing any more time in. And all these things that are linked together by some common thread all go there, and everybody knows that they're there.
Okay. Well, my husband would, if he's hearing this, he's probably thinking what she really wants to do is just throw it all away, but I won't let her. To my mind, getting rid of it might be the best way to manage all the information overload from that stuff, but that's just a difference between him and I. So let's actually move to the workplace, which is another area in which not only do you have to keep yourself organized, but you're working within an organization itself, and that presents some restrictions. So how do we keep ourselves organized, our minds organized in the workplace?
Well, so there's a lot of different aspects to this. And let's talk about just one, and that is how to be productive and efficient, to keep your workday organized. And I think so many of us feel as though we are overloaded and overwhelmed by all the things that are happening, and that we can't stop work for even 5 minutes or we'll fall behind. But that gets back to the multitasking thing in a way. The idea that if we don't take breaks, we're not being productive, you know, we're being more productive. And the neuroscience literature is very clear on this. There's a mode of our brain that is responsible for most of our creativity. It's called the default mode network, or the daydreaming mode. Mm-hmm. And it's the part of your brain that effectively hits the reset button in your brain when you've gotten overstressed or you've run into a brick wall in your work. So one of the biggest things we can do in the workplace is to give ourselves an opportunity to enter that daydreaming mode every couple of hours or so. You do that by reading literature, by listening to music, looking out the window. The best thing is to take a walk in nature. According to many studies, people who take regular breaks and even naps, 10 or 15 minute naps, have been more productive at the end of the day and more creative in their work, more than making up for the amount of time they take off.
Hmm. Well, let's take a call here because we've got several people who've got some questions. Sandy is calling from Malden. You're on the air, Sandy.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you. My question is about calendars, because I attempt to be organized by putting everything on calendars, but I have a calendar on my phone, a calendar in my kitchen, and then I cancel an appointment and I forget to take it off one calendar and it's still on the other calendar and it ends up making things worse. So I don't know. It's like tough to deal with that.
Daniel Levinson, go ahead.
Oh, calendaring is a great organizational tip, and it's consistent with the idea of externalizing your memory. And some people really use their calendars very effectively. Suppose you are just leaving the doctor and the doctor says, I want to see you again in 6 months. Before you come in, I want you to do this blood work, and you have to do it 15 days before you see me. So you put all that in your calendar right at that moment, the doctor's appointment, the 15 days out so you remember to get to the lab. Maybe you make yourself a note for later this afternoon to call the lab so you have an appointment. You put all that in the calendar. Now, the problem that our caller is describing is multiple calendars.
Exactly.
I'm reminded of the saying that was attributed to Confucius, a man with one watch always knows what time it is. a man with two watches is never sure. So I think there exist now technologies where the same calendar on your phone can appear on your laptop and your tablet and your computer. It can't populate the paper calendar in your kitchen, but you can synchronize all these calendars so that any entry in one shows up on the other, and maybe make it an exercise for yourself or the kids to, every day check the computer calendar and fill in the calendar on the kitchen wall.
To me, this is linking back to the idea of streamlining and conscientiousness, right?
Yeah. So you want to train the kids to be conscientious. Maybe they got to work on the calendar 2 or 3 days in advance, but, train them early.
We're going to talk about young people and organized minds in just a second, but there's another call I'd like to take. Kristen is calling from Londonderry in New Hampshire. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Daniel. I have a question for people whose lives are genuinely overwhelming. Many people tell me that my life is completely overwhelming. I work full-time as a high school teacher. I have 6 children under the age of 8, including 2-year-old triplets. And I have an extraordinarily difficult time managing all of the incoming stimuli that go with all of those things. So all of the kids come home with little bits of paper that need to be signed and returned, and some of them need money, and some of them need information from the insurance or the doctor, and they have homework, and I have to check the homework and sign where I check the homework, and then there's my own job and the students that I need to keep track of. So I was curious what you think of as the really biggest bang for your buck things to do for people who genuinely, objectively, just do have a lot to keep track of. It's not a feeling of being overwhelmed. It's, wow, that really is a lot.
That does sound overwhelming. Well, one of the things that the experts that I spoke with, highly successful, productive people, recommend is writing things down. Get things out of your head whenever you can. So we were talking about this earlier. If you've got a to-do list, don't even try to keep it in your head. Write it down. And what a lot of people recommend is putting one item on separate 3x5 cards.
Yeah. In the book, you actually mentioned how Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook does exactly this, right?
In the heart of Silicon Valley. She keeps a notebook, but the idea of 3x5 cards, a lot of people use, they're somewhat stiff, so they hold their shape. One idea per card, you can resort them, you throw out the card when you're done with it, so you know it's done. But in your particular case, it sounds like having some kind of systems in place, like a basket where the kids have to put at home stuff that needs to be signed, so it all goes in one place, and they know that, and you train them. And maybe some kind of a whiteboard at home where each kid writes down on it what they need from you that evening, right? Andrea needs you to check her homework, and Billy needs you to sign this note, and Charlie needs you to help him with a project. Whatever it is, have them self-organized to some degree so you know what's expected of you. And, throughout the day, as things occur to you, write them down so that they're not overwhelming you in your head. And then sort them, prioritize them, maybe several times throughout the day, so that you can ensure that when the day's end comes, you've done the most important thing.
So let's talk about kids a little bit more before we run out of too much time, because, part of the reason why, as at the start of our discussion, that we mentioned that people feel so overwhelmed is just we are, as the subtitle of your book says, living in an age of information overload. But we also at the same time think of kids as quote-unquote digital natives, that they're just born into this fire hose of info, so they should be able to handle it. But we're seeing evidence that they still have the brains of those hunter-gatherers as well, and so maybe their difficulty is distinguishing between relative value in different kinds of information.
That's a really crucial point, because I think we're at a time in history where the primary mission of teachers and parents has to shift from trying to teach just a whole bunch of information and facts because no need to teach them anymore. Everybody has them in their palm at the touch of a button. The primary mission has to shift to teach the next generation, the people who are going to be in control of things not long from now, teach them to discern valid from invalid information, facts from pseudo-facts, to recognize that there are hierarchies of sources of information. Well, you were talking in the earlier segment about testimony.
Eyewitness testimony,
this is a good model for it. There are different kinds of eyewitness testimony, right? There's somebody who said, I saw this person do it, and this is what I remember they look like. There's another level, which is, I took a video, and yes, Your Honor, I'm the one who took the video, and I'm going to show it to you now, and so you can see, you know, the cell phone video. I'm authenticating this thing that I took, which you can now use in the trial. Those are very different standards of evidence, right? A memory versus an actual recording. Mm-hmm. We see standards of evidence in many different ways. Suppose that you go to look up on the web information about a drug. What every 8-year-old should be taught is to ask the question, whose website did I land on, and what bias or self-interest might they have in the way they report the information? Is it the drug company who manufactures the drug? Maybe it's a competing company. Maybe it's a shill company with a funny name like Americans for Better Medicine that's actually acting in a biased way.
So discerning, being discerning about information, also one of the keys to having an organized mind. Daniel Levitin, professor of psychology and behavioral neuroscience at McGill University and author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I'm feeling more organized as we speak. I should also mention again that Daniel Levitin will be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight. There's more information about that at radioboston.org. And with that, we're done. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.